Welcome to the Actionable Futurist podcast, a show all about the near-term future with practical and actionable advice from a range of global experts to help you stay ahead of the curve. Every episode answers the question, what's the future of? With voices and opinions that need to be heard. Your host is international keynote speaker and actionable futurist Andrew Grill.
Today's guests are Dr. Simon Wallace, Chief Clinical Information Officer at Nuance Communications, and Umang Patel, Chief Clinical Information Officer at Microsoft. Simon is a GP and public health doctor providing consultancy services to healthcare organizations. He has 20 years of commercial experience modernizing and improving the delivery of healthcare. Previously, he was at Hutchison 3G, AXA, Triple P Healthcare, Bupa, FIFA, GSK, Optima Life, and WorldCare UK. Umang has worked across commercial and public sectors in healthcare, both from payer and provider perspectives, and was an early employee at Babylon Health, and an NHS Leadership Academy Fellow and practicing clinician at Frimley Health. Welcome both of you to the podcast.
Thank you, Andrew. Great to be here.
Thank you very much, Andrew. Delighted to be here.
Now, I've known both companies for a long time. In fact, the Australian voice of Siri, Karen Jacobson, will be on the show soon, and she worked with Nuance many years ago providing the voice samples for what ultimately became Siri. Now, some very exciting news. Microsoft's agreed to acquire Nuance Communications for $19.7 billion, and the transaction is now approved and complete. So could you explain to our audience how important this alliance is and what it will mean for the healthcare industry going forward?
Firstly, I think it's really exciting. One of the reasons I joined Microsoft was because I read about the potential acquisition of Nuance and bringing the companies together that got me really excited. One of the big challenges we have with bringing technology into healthcare is a general cynicism that comes across from the front line about, well, is this really going to help me? Is this going to save me time so I can help my patients more? Or is it going to be another set of passwords I have to remember and another annoyance to my day? And when you look at what Nuance have got, they go, look, absolutely, we're entirely designed to save you time. Rather than you tapping away at keys, we can use the conversational AI, we can use our speech recognition to make sure that you save minutes per patient that rolls up into hours per day. And when I look at what Microsoft have got, you can see this sort of underpinning enterprise scale technology that allows us to deliver that not only to people on the front line in each department, but across integrated care systems and beyond. So bringing the two companies together, I think, was a real step in the right direction for saying technology in healthcare is here to stay. It's going to be increasingly usable and we're going to get better outcomes as a result.
So fascinating story. How did the acquisition actually come about?
We weren't necessarily around when they first started, but from what I understand, it was just one of those partnerships that just blossomed. So when I talk to people that have been in Microsoft longer than me, they go, well, we just love talking about Nuance to our healthcare clients because of the reasons I've just articulated. So as we sort of started talking more and more, it became increasingly apparent that we should form up and have a deeper relationship. So as a sellers from a Microsoft perspective, we're talking to our clients, saying, actually, this is how we can help you and look at the great things that are coming downstream with companies and partners like Nuance. It became clearer and clearer that deeper integrations were needed and sort of one thing led to another, I guess. And now we're part of the same company.
So Simon, maybe you could outline how instrumental Nuance has been in the emergence of conversational AI.
It probably might be an idea just to explain what we mean by conversational AI. It's the clinician no longer hunched over the keyboard typing, but instead the desktop computer has gone out of the room and there's a purpose-built healthcare device on the wall with a multi-microphone array and sensors. And voice biometrics play a role in being able to do two things. One, identify the clinician so that he or she is not having to log in. My voice is my password. This is used in banking and at the HMRC today. But then those voice biometrics then diarize the whole conversation between the patient and the clinician. And then smart natural language processing in the background is picking out the key clinical terms that have been talked about, and then putting those into a structured, codified note. So at the end of the consultation, a note is produced using technology that allows the clinician and the patient to have that direct interaction without a clinician having to type it out over the keyboard.
It's fascinating. I can understand how much time it's going to save. And I've always thought that voice is the next frontier. And of course, this is voice with permission. So you're actively saying, I want to tell this machine something and I want them to make some sense of it. After LinkedIn, this is Microsoft's largest deal ever at $19.7 billion. So it signals Microsoft is serious about healthcare. So what can we expect to see from Microsoft going forward in this area?
Hopefully lots more. You're bang on, right? It was a huge acquisition and really important to have that marker in the sand of intent. So one of the things that we're doing at Microsoft and really trying to help our partners go through is this move to being able to compute at levels that we've never been able to do before. So as we often talk about moving stuff to the cloud, I think sometimes that gets lost in there. Okay, I get it, but like why? So I can store stuff somewhere different. Okay, I get that might be a bit more helpful. But the actual storage is somewhat irrelevant to the computing power that allows to happen. So when I think about what that might end up meaning for clinical practice, you know, way back when, you know, 1948, when the NHS was formed, we were all using information that was coming out of studies where we were using a few thousand people and measuring what we could. Whereas today, there's been a billion-fold increase in the amount of information that's collected to understand what we need to do for healthcare. So medical research is just exponentially grown in the amount of data that's used in it. One of the things we're trying to get with Microsoft is how can we then start taking all of this extra data, you know, your genomic profiling, precision medicine, the big data stuff that we've talked about for a while now, how can we start making that usable? And if we can start making it usable and putting it onto the desks of doctors and nurses around the country, in fact, around the world, then we think we can really shift healthcare onto the next frontier. And when you start trying to show people what that can really look like and how that can be touched and felt, that's where nuance comes in as a real way of saying, look, it's already here. This isn't something that's going to happen in the future. It's something that we can do now.
For our global audience, we should probably explain the NHS as the National Health Service. It's the jewel in the crown here. It's a very unique health service. And of course, both of you have been involved in it for many, many years. It gets a fair share of criticism. I think it's probably, as an Australian living in the UK, we all envy it and we all love it. And the other side of the pandemic, we all appreciate how much everyone strives to do so much. We've seen tech is transforming the NHS, and you just explain in some ways that that's going to happen. But can tech restore it to full health?
The two answers to that question, if I may, one is absolutely, but you've obviously got a biased audience on here. And secondly, I don't know what other choice we have, right? So healthcare is not like making biscuits. We can't just stop. We've got to carry on. And, you know, throughout every industry and throughout history, we've seen technological advances be the answer to solving problems that seemed intractable. You know, there was a time when people couldn't believe that there was anything other than a horse and cart. Then came along the motor car. For all of the problems that we may have with it today, it solved huge problems back then. So I'm really hopeful and actually entirely believe that we're standing at that same juncture. So as you start moving things onto different computing models, greater computing power and better connectivity, I think we're going to shift away from some of the challenges that we see in healthcare today as being insurmountable to being able to be more positive about the future. And I think, do you know what? We can solve this backlog crisis. It's okay that everybody's living longer because we've got solutions that will help us going forward to be more efficient and lead to better outcomes.
We talked about data, and when we talk about medical data, it's a very sensitive topic, and the importance of data privacy is very relevant when it comes to medical data. So how can we best balance the good that open data can do to save lives with the need to protect patient privacy?
You're exactly right. So one of the biggest problems you've got with healthcare and data is being able to enable that trust. So healthcare has always been based on the trust that patients have with their clinicians. When we start translating that into new technological formats and different ways of delivering that care, we need to feed that through. I think this is an area that Microsoft's really strong in. You know, we've worked with the NHS for 40 odd years now. Being able to build on that already trusted relationship is key. And then also being able to show people that what we're doing is safe and secure. And the best way of doing that is showing people through various case studies, implementing it across hospitals, and winning the front line over. So we spent a long time thinking about how do we tell patients about data and what that might mean. And actually, I think for patients, the problem when they come to healthcare is that they're scared already, and having another thought process to go through is too difficult. Whereas now, as we're seeing more and more clinicians get involved and start being able to talk to their patients about it, we're seeing that trust is being more easily earned. And of course, having earned it, it's really important for us to make sure that we keep it.
Data privacy is really important. And I guess it needs to be balanced with the public understanding the importance of clinicians having data at their fingertips, information at their fingertips when they're seeing patients. Healthcare has just become so much more complex over the last 15, 20 years, and clinicians are needing to have that support of information about the patient, also sort of guidelines, pathways, all those good sorts of things. And I think if the public understand that there's a, you know, the information is really, really important, that if it is safe and secure, then that sort of psyche, if you like, that mindset will become much more understandable from the public's point of view.
Yeah, I think it's about trust. And once we know we can trust our healthcare providers and that feedback loop, we know that by giving away a little bit of data, it provides me with better healthcare or faster healthcare. I think we're going to warm to that and actually overtly want to give data. We'll talk a bit later on about data in the consumer sec, but I would happily give data to my clinician, my GP, if I knew it was going to give me a better diagnosis. But Umang, you were one of the early employees at Babylon, and perhaps for our global audience, you might explain where Babylon fits in the health tech space. But what did you learn about the power of AI and data when you were there when it comes to transforming healthcare?
So I joined Babylon way back when there was a company of about 10 people. And for context, it was a company, and maybe if I tell this story, I met the founder, Ali Parser, for a coffee. And he said, look, rather than talking about technology in healthcare, what about if we just take the best that we can do today and really try and drive it through and see how far we can get with it? And that was generally the ethos that we had. The fact that we could click a few buttons to book an appointment with a doctor. We created a telemedicine service that was empowered by some AI as well to try and deliver some of the best tech into patients' hands. And we grew that company from the 10 people from when I started to around 3,500 people in an IPO late last year. So in the global context, we became the largest primary care provider in the UK pretty quickly. We raised, I think we IPO'd at about $4.2 billion. So we became quite big and a tech unicorn. And to answer your question, there were two things that I really took from that experience that I think are important to share. The first is, as we start thinking about how we deal with patients and we start talking about data and other things, we forget that actually they're consumers sometimes, and we treat them too much like patients, and we don't treat them like citizens. And we sort of coined this phrase about consumer-grade healthcare. What is it that people really want and need? And when we took a step back and tried to design the 7-star service, as it were, for healthcare, we were like, well, what are the pain points? And back at the early days of Babylon, we were like, okay, well, one of the hardest things with seeing a doctor was getting an appointment with a doctor because you had to phone a receptionist. So we changed that to just 3 clicks. You know, can I click a button here, choose a time, book an appointment, and then see a doctor? And by delighting our users with that experience, we earned their trust, then move on to being able to do the next part, which is then see their doctor. When they realized that they could see their doctor, they were then going, oh, well, now that I'm not scared about having now that I'm not scared because I can't see my doctor, or I'm going to have to wait a long time for it, I'll start to trust some of the more techie elements of it. So I'll use some of the AI that we put in to answer questions through a chatbot or enter my information into a health assessment digital twin type process too. So we learned that what you had to do was take the problem that was facing the patient or the person straight away, solve that problem in order to earn the trust. And then the second thing that we learned was that when you do start doing that, you suddenly scale a lot quicker than you might have anticipated. So like I mentioned, we became the largest GP practice in the country pretty quickly. And I remember when we launched, we reached the front page of the Times with the headline, you know, the doctor will see you now, or whatever it was, but on your phone. And can you imagine today that being like, even, it's not even newsworthy, right? It's taken for granted. In fact, today we saw in the press in the UK that we're expecting the NHS app to have that functionality put into it relatively soon. What we learned was that because you scale so quickly, because you've actually solved a problem that matters to people, you run out of some things pretty sharpish. One of those was the ability to have doctors to serve those patients. So it didn't matter what we did, right? We didn't have a magic doctor tree that meant we could grow more clinical, a bigger clinical workforce fast enough. And that's why we started to try and use AI to lift some of that burden away, to make sure we got the right patient to the right place at the right time. And we did that with varying degrees of success. Some of it worked really well. Some of it, do you know what, we did it and we thought it was going to be amazing, and it turned out that it just didn't solve anybody's problems. But through that process, we learned that, you know, it's really important to iterate, and it's really important to have scale at the heart of your thinking, because whenever you set up a service, again, it took us by surprise at how big we became so quickly. And one of the advantages of working at an organization like Microsoft, for example, is that, you know, scale sort of baked into anything that you might do. So I'm really excited about how we turn healthcare from what might have been more of a sort of isolated industry before into something that's really enterprise ready. So how can we take healthcare and start applying some of those enterprise type factors into it in order to help make sure we see as many patients as possible reap the benefits?
Two things I love about what you just said. One is that you want to see people as customers. And I think when we think about customers, we think about customer care and a great experience. And I think that would be a fundamental shift when everyone in the whole ecosystem is thinking about, well, we have to think about a net promoter score. We care when we go into a John Lewis, or we interface with an Amazon or a Netflix, that we have a great experience. And we want to have that great experience when we're being treated, when we're not feeling well. And the other thing that I think we'll see a lot of is digital twins. Those on the podcast will have heard me talk a lot about IoT and the fact that you can actually have a digital twin for an aeroplane or a building. But I think the human digital twin, and this comes back to data privacy, if I could actually have my own digital twin and it would actually be living, breathing, looking at how I'm performing when I feed real-time data back to it or clinician data, I think that's probably something that is a quantum leap in using technology to save lives. We might talk about that a bit later on, but Simon, what can we expect to see when it comes to innovation now the two companies have joined forces?
Innovation is key. I think a couple of things that will come to the fore is we'll move faster into the cloud. One of the key things about speech recognition is being able to, for clinicians to be able to use this as a cloud-based service. It gives them more flexibility, and it makes them more nimble to be able to use it. And we certainly saw that during COVID when clinicians were able to use speech from home. So I think the ability of both of our organizations coming together, the whole direction of cloud-based speech recognition is only going to accelerate further. I think the other area is around teleconsultations. That obviously, again, came to the fore during COVID. And we're going through this pivot at the moment, aren't we, of sort of getting a balance between the appropriate face-to-face consultation versus what can be done more remotely. And what's interesting, we talked about customers and consumers. What do they really want? Well, we did a survey last year, and we found that just under half, around about 47% of UK patients would choose to rely solely on a face-to-face appointment. And that was down by about a fifth from 64% pre-pandemic. But innovation is around making sure that we get that balance right, that we get that sort of doctor-patient relationship balance, so that too much technology doesn't dampen, if you like, the sensitivities of that quite unique interaction between two individuals.
We've come out the other side of the pandemic, let's hope. So I'm interested, from maybe both of you, what we've learned from the pandemic in terms of how to drive innovation and process development that the NHS and broader healthcare providers may not have been exposed to had we not had the experience of the last 2 years.
Building on the digital twin thing, something really exciting happened during the pandemic, aside from all of the devastation that it caused, and that was just our absolute necessity, and whatever that quote is, you know, about necessity being the mother of invention, which allowed us to look outside of our sort of the way that we were doing things. And just by way of story, and trying to build in the digital twin component as well, I remember our CTO at Babylon, for example, saying he joined us from McLaren, being like, well, if I have a race car, I run it around almost every track in the world 100 times to see how it might perform in its digital twin format before I even pick up, you know, or let the team pick up a single spanner to start putting it together. And when you think about for healthcare, we do the exact opposite. We wait for the body to go wrong, and then we look at what that is, and we go, okay, well, now that it's gone wrong, let's see what chemical processes we can change or manipulate or physiology we can change in order to try and stick a plaster over it and get the patient back to full health. So that mind shift, I think, has is really needed, and I think now has enabled us to go there. And looking at other industries has been one of the key benefits for innovation, I think, post-pandemic. We saw people really coming through. We saw engineering companies building ventilators, as an example, and everybody pulling towards that. You know, is there anything more important than our healthcare? I'm not sure. And with that in mind, how can we all pull together to in order to sort of learn from each other, really try and pump prime the innovation that is needed in healthcare, get it to that scalable enterprise level? And I think some of the things that we've been talking about here and some of the things that we've got in the pipeline between Nuance and Microsoft, for example, sort of capture that. And we're really excited to take that forward, show people what the future can look like, and also point out that when we talk about the future, we're not talking about things that are 10 years away. We're talking about things that we think we can do, you know, in the next 1-3 years.
The crisis, it gave everyone permission. Well, it forced them and gave permission to be innovative, because we had to. There was just that need in a crisis that people really did not know how it was all going to go, to actually lock horns and really get on and do things and not be held back by bureaucracy and process. There was just a need that it had to be done. I mean, one example that came out was the NHS app. People started using the NHS app simply because it was the way that their COVID vaccination sort of evidence could be used. It brought an app that was doing okay-ish, but it brought it center stage. And going forward, we need to sort of be building on that so that all the benefits of that type of technology can be realized.
Yeah, you're right. Probably everyone I know has the NHS app on their phone because they had to. The other interesting byproduct, I had been a huge QR code skeptic years ago, thinking, how are we going to use these? I don't know anyone that doesn't know what a QR code is and having scanned one to either get their NHS passport or check into a venue. So the rise of QR codes has been one interesting byproduct from the pandemic.
Yeah, and also just using our phones for cash interactions, that whole dynamic at the till has completely changed. A lot of it around the sort of the hygiene side of things. Very interesting how that probably accelerated far more than it would have done.
I was amazed with the acceleration. So I talked to all of my corporate audiences about how things have accelerated so quickly. I famously stood on stage in January 2020 and talked about the things that might happen in 2 or 3 or 4 years. And all these things we've talked about have been accelerated. So if anything good has come out of the pandemic, it is the realization that technology can be used for good, and things like QR codes and paying at the till and those sort of things are here and now, and everyone's used to it. Just on the technology angle there, I'm one of the millions of people that has a fitness tracker. So how far away are we from my GP being able to leverage that data in a regular or predictive way?
Not very far at all. I mean, like, I had a patient the other day, so my proper job, if you like, is being a paediatrician. I had the family come in, and their child had a temperature. So they'd come in with this recurring temperature, and it was obviously worrying them. And the dad just pulled out and he said, I don't know if there's a help doctor, but I've been recording it. And he'd been recording it in an Excel spreadsheet, and then just showed me the graph of the temperature. It was, like, incredibly helpful to be able to see it. So now, that was just somebody doing something off their own back. But it really struck me about how people are going, well, just, but this is how I do stuff now. Why wouldn't I just capture it in this way and bring it along with me? So I don't think we're very far away at all from being able to see that in live consultations. And as we start putting more EPRs in, as we start having that better data integration, I think as a clinician, I'll be sat there fully expecting to be able to see what my patient's blood pressure was or their temperature were at home being read by their device. And I think that's another really exciting innovation. And I'd expect us just sort of nail myself to a mast on this. I think within the next 2 years, that'll be relatively commonplace, especially for people with chronic conditions.
You'll be happy to know that I'm a bit of a geek and have a bunch of IoT devices. I weigh myself every morning with my WeThings scale. I have a WeThings watch that measures all my vitals. And also I have a little temperature device that is Wi-Fi connected. So I could actually download all that data to my physician. I suppose the issue is the friction between it's in one device, it's in Apple HealthKit. Are the GPs ready to have this data downloaded? It's all very well to show them the screen. I suppose my question, it's a two-part question, is there a way for me to actually import that data into some system and make sense of it?
I think there will be. It goes back to that enterprise scale. So I think you're right. Today, we don't think about healthcare as being enterprise ready. So, you know, if it was an organization, imagine if that was you submitting, you know, acne report into your company or going through a purchasing order or whatever else it might be in the corporate world. If we take that type of thinking and then apply that to healthcare, we'll get there, right? So, okay, well, I've got this information, I need to upload it or get it into a system. We'll be able to find a way for that. And, you know, I don't think that's very far away. And then the second part, and this is always talking about how we need to use the cloud and transition into that new way of interacting and that new ability to compute. As a clinician, I can't possibly have all of the data points, assess them, and then be useful to you. So going back to my example, wonderfully, this family had been recording their child's temperature every half an hour for 2 days. So the actual spreadsheet that I saw was way too detailed. And it, you know, really what I needed to see was the insights that were called out of that. And I wanted to know what the peak temperature was and how often it went above a certain line. And so by moving to cloud, by changing processes and using the latest AI and clinical systems to be able to do that, I think we'll be able to take this data and make it usable so that when I am looking at the dashboard or talking to my patient, I'll be able to see the pertinent bits of information that will help me make the right assessment rather than just having all of the data there for the having the data's for sort of having the data there for data's sake.
So Simon, back to what Nuance do, what's the untapped power of speech and AI in a healthcare setting?
I always go back to this wonderful quote from Professor Sir Cyril Chandler, where he said, medicine used to be simple, ineffective, and safe. But today it's complex, effective, but dangerous. And it all sort of hovers around the importance of having clinical documentation. But the trouble is with clinical documentation, it's a real chore and a real pain for clinicians. They spend something like 11 to 12 hours per week creating their documentation. So where speech comes along is trying to take out that burden. When we first started our podcast, I painted this vision of conversational AI and what's coming down the track. But today, just using speech recognition by creating your notes using a microphone to get your consultation into an admission note, into a discharge summary, into an outpatient letter, that has real opportunity to speed up that the time taken to do that chore. We speak three times faster than we actually type. And certainly our experience in different areas show that that's been a real benefit. I think the other really important thing about speech, and there may be some listeners who've tried it maybe 10 years ago and were slightly put off because of a need for correction, is that the word recognition now today is really very, very good. And the reason it is because the speech engines have changed in the way they are built and operate. It's based on AI, deep learning, and sophisticated algorithms supported by a comprehensive medical dictionary. And what that's done it has meant that clinicians can now speak their notes, actually see the words come out on page where the cursor is, and not have to be doing any correction. So there's that area of supporting them with their clinical notes, but they can also use it for their email. They can also use it in Word if they're getting a presentation or a proposal together for a conference. And at other areas we've seen it useful is users that may have dyslexia or have some repetitive strain injury from the keyboard. So there's been a whole host of areas where it's taken off. And I think just in summary, we're making this cultural shift from the keyboard to our voice. And that's going to make a huge difference going forward in trying to reduce the burden of clinical documentation, which in itself, going back to Sir Cyril's quote, is so important to maintain.
Yeah, you're right about the improvement in voice recognition or speech recognition. I remember years ago trying to train these systems and being frustrated. It's interesting the anecdote that you talk three times faster than you type. I probably talk about five times faster than I type. I use speech recognition every day. I would love to try your system. I try another system at the moment to transcribe the podcast. Gets it about 80 or 90% right. It always gets my name and the name of the podcast wrong. And I'm thinking, why don't you learn that? I do it every week. That'd be interesting to see if I could use that to transcribe podcasts.
I think that's interesting. I mean, that type of recognition is not great. The engines of today, and certainly they need to have that clinical robustness, a 99% plus accurate. And I think the thing about the engines today is they're always learning from every time you speak. So I will have my individual profile. It will be in the cloud. And every time I'm using it, it's learning, it's improving, it's getting even better at the recognition.
So two-part question, maybe one for each of you. What's the healthcare professional of the future look like? And what's the hospital of the future look like?
The healthcare professional of the future, let me start with that. I got to go back to some basics. And, you know, Umang and myself both being clinicians, that they must all have listening skills and compassion that health professionals have always had. That's absolutely key. But as I stated just a moment ago, because healthcare has become so much more complex, they need to have quality information at their fingertips to make often life critical decisions. And I think the healthcare professional of the future will be dependent on having that type of resource when he or she is consulting. And I guess it goes back to what I was just saying, that type of confidence in having access to that source will only come about if there's been good clinical documentation along the way. So the healthcare of the professional will be hopefully much less bogged down and burdened by admin and excessive admin chores, and having that much sort of healthier face-to-face interaction with the patient.
Healthcare professional of the future will probably look younger, because doctors always look younger to me nowadays, but they probably look younger and will just look less stressed and be more present. I mean, that's what I'd love to see, is us being able to sit there and be, I'm with you as a patient because you're here now. And a lot of the preamble and the bits that have needed to be done have been done, and I can concentrate on what we need to get done in this interaction, because I'm not, bombarded by having to write my notes or do other bits and pieces which are distracting me from doing what I really love doing, which is treating you. And to pick up on what I think the hospital of the future looks like, I think it looks like a really exciting place. I think it looks like the sort of place where, you get dropped off rather than having to battle for parking for 2 hours and worrying about how much that's going to cost. You're able to then get in, be automatically booked in. We talked about QR codes, and I love that, some of this technology that is relatively simple and very simple in its deployment, if maybe not in its setup, means that it's now accessible to, my grandmother as well as, any 25-year-old. So we can bring these things in that allow us to be able to use technology. So as you walk through, you'll be able to check in, be automatically routed through to the next part of the process, the right information being put there. I'd love us to be able to start having things like HoloLens involved too. So when you go in and see the doctor, it's not just the doctor or the nurse that's in front of you that's limiting their ability to care for you. The whole of the multidisciplinary team might be able to join remotely or in a hybrid way. That will mean that as you come in, we can maximize the time that you're spending in the hospital to make sure that it's an experience that is as good as it can be. I don't think anybody goes to a hospital thinking it's going to be Disneyland, but when you're there, feeling that the patient, that as a patient, knowing that your clinicians know everything they need to know about you in order to inform the next step of your care, and leave in an efficient way that will mean that you feel confident that you're going to get what you need and, hopefully get better and thrive.
I was going to say, just building on that, I think the hospitals will also need to have that much stronger seamless link with community and social care, and I hope technology will be able to play a role so that transition back into the community, having had the experience for whatever reason in hospital, is much more seamless and works much better, so that communication link is much improved.
You're so right. Friends of mine that have had operations, they've come out of the hospital, that safe environment, they're back in the community as friends and carers. We're not quite sure how to look after them. Another futurist type question. As a futurist, I'm always asked about the future of healthcare, and I've got two experts in front of me, so I'm going to ask you. I often offer that we're not far away from being able to swallow a digital pill that can diagnose us in a more dynamic way. Is this just a futurist dream, or do you think it'll become a reality?
I think it'll be a reality. I predict that we'll have an artificial pancreas before we have that pill. As an example, I don't think we're that far away from being able to solve diabetes, for example. I think we're close to that. I think we're years and years and years away from being able to solve some of the mental health challenges that we find. And I say this quite a lot, but I often say that I think mental health is our generation's diabetes. But I'm optimistic that we'll find a solution to diabetes, and therefore I'm hopeful with some of the things we've talked about today, big data, better analysis, etc., we'll be able to start working on the same solutions for mental health. I think the pill you describe, I do wonder if what you describe as a futurist doesn't quite match when we think about it as clinicians, because having a pill that will diagnose things is only a small part of the challenge. But I definitely do see us having things that we can swallow, having extra wearables and other bits that will give us a much greater picture. So it's not just about diagnosis, it's about, you know, being able to optimize the onward care as well.
Oh, as a futurist, we have the asterisk next to everything we say all the time because we'd like to have it happen. I have these crazy ideas and then I actually get grounded and I test them on my guests like yourself. So I learn more from my guests than you'll ever learn from me. And back to what I think Simon said before is that doctor and the clinician, they have to have empathy. And that's something you can't teach through AI, because I know from people I'm involved with that are, carers and clinicians, they do the job you do because they have an overriding desire to make people better. And that is a drive that is not in everyone and not something you can replicate in AI. So never want to take the humans out of that. In fact, when I've done some research on what jobs can never be replaced by AI, top of the list is clinicians, because you have to have that level of empathy and knowing how to diagnose something that's in front of you rather than just relying on some technology. So glad to hear clinicians and the humans are still involved. As a futurist, I want the humans to be involved when you're looking at what's wrong with me.
It's a very important point. And we always talk about the sixth sense and the art of practicing medicine. It's one of those components that when someone comes in, you just have a hunch and you need to follow that through. And often there's something there that you hadn't anticipated. In fact, with voice, there's been some work done where the voice, the waves, the sound waves from the voice can be analyzed. And give some indication on the well-being of that individual. Is that person slightly more anxious? Is there a sort of a depressive sort of component? And certainly when as GPs and hospital clinicians having our 10 or 15 minutes with patients, we're rushing, we're trying to get the thing that they came in for, the main reason they came in for, addressed. But there might be something subtle going on that's actually being portrayed in the tone of their voice, which we may miss because we're just simply rushing. And so that technology there is of interest, and it'll be I'm watching that keenly to see how that evolves over the next few years.
Well, actually, I talk about that and the notion of ambient voice in the future of voice, that having permission to record what's going on. So you might say, you know, have someone present and you say, look, I'd like to use this newfangled technology. We're going to record what we're saying. But as you say, it then picks up on the nuances. And if I'm not having a good day and it knows how I normally talk, I think that could be incredibly powerful, not just in a clinical environment, but actually in the workplace, that it detects that today I'm just not myself. And maybe it triggers someone to say, my buddy, hey, can you just check in on Andrew? I think you're right about mental health being our diabetes of our lifetime. And if voice can help that, but again, with permission, if we can trust that technology is being used for good, and that's a big ask in some places, then maybe voice can be used to see how we're feeling. I think that's a huge area. You'd be happy to know that I talk about that with my audiences. That's one of the good, positive, forward uses of voice.
Agree. I mean, it's like when I phone my mum, regardless of what's going on, she'll always know if, you know, I've had a good day or a bad day, but, you know, even if we're, you know, just in the way that we say hello and stuff. And I would love to see us bringing that more to the fore in healthcare. And healthcare is a very verbal industry, right? We're not like finance. We're not sat behind spreadsheets and other bits and pieces. Like, healthcare is based on communication. So vital that we start utilizing it in the best ways possible.
Almost out of time, so I might just ask both of you, what's the one project you've worked on that you're most proud of?
I guess mine was being involved with a primary care clinic in the Gambia. We had no money, and we had to raise some money from various sources. One of the key things was being able to get 700 malaria nets into this small remote village, because just by doing that, we knew how much malaria would go through the village each year. By having the nets there, that actually reduced that to almost zero. The other thing that we did was with some funding was trained three villagers to become midwives, really. There was a lot of mortality from births not being managed as well as they could do. So completely non-techie in my answer to that question, but I think that, you know, that has really left a mark of a sense of real achievement with me over the years.
As I think about that, the top of my mind comes to some of the work we did with Babylon in Wolverhampton. And for me, one of the reasons I'm so proud of it was because we started this, you know, bringing technology into healthcare, and, you know, we had our critics and people would say, you know, you're deliberately being disruptive and, you know, are you doing the right thing? And we then went and we took it to Wolverhampton. We broke out of London and we went to Wolverhampton. We put it within the NHS services with some great local GPs that were already aligned to the hospital trust to break down that those barriers between primary care and secondary care and deliver better patient care. And all along that way, we were told, you know, you can't do this. It's never been done before. The type of contracting doesn't exist. But we managed to get it through. So I was really proud. For me, that was a watershed moment when I just knew we'd jumped the chasm from people saying, oh, this is something that only exists for people that have got iPhones in London and have enough money to be able to use them, et cetera, to being something that I could just see being the exact requirement and future of healthcare that we're going to be delivering. And so I'm very proud of that.
Both great stories. Now, we're at the favourite part of the podcast. I want to run you both through a quick fire round. Now, with both of you, what I'm going to do is ask you alternately. So maybe you'll start with you, Umang. iPhone or Android?
Android.
Window or aisle?
Window.
Online or in the room?
In the room.
Your biggest hope for 2022?
That everybody starts thinking about healthcare as being something that can be done at scale with technology now rather than in 10 years.
Simon, the app you use most on your phone?
WhatsApp or BBC News.
What's the one thing you won't be doing again post-pandemic?
Drinking so much latte.
I'm going to ask both of you the next three quick questions. What are you reading at the moment?
I'm reading United Nations by Frank Connolly, and it's about the opportunities and challenges of a united Ireland.
But I'm reading the latest Jack Reacher book because I just can't get enough of that.
I'll put the links to those in the podcast because people like to know what our guests are reading. Next question for both of you. Who should I invite next onto the podcast?
I was going to say either Chris Whitty or Patrick Vallance to try and get some real insight into what happened during COVID. Failing that, Roy Lilly, he'll give you the real nuts and bolts about what's going on in the NHS.
I would say Sajid Javid or Amanda Pritchard, having heard them recently at NHS Confed Expo, talk really passionately about how powerful the NHS is in leading the world forward as we get to more digital and more transformation.
Well, no pressure then to get those high-profile guests. Actually, you heard Sir Patrick present at London Tech Week a few weeks ago. He was very impressive, even though he only spoke for 5 minutes. Final question for both of you. How do you want to be remembered?
As an optimist.
For me, having been a good egg.
Two great answers. Now, as this is the Actionable Futurist podcast, I'm going to ask you what three actionable things should our audience do today when it comes to better understanding the benefits of digital health solutions?
First, go and have a look at what other people are doing so you can convince yourself that it's real and tangible and you can do it. The second is ask them how they did it rather than having to reinvent it in your own way. And the third is, again, going back to asking, like just ask anybody you can how they can help you get to where you want to be. So start with a conversation because I think people will be surprised at what is available and how willing people are to help them get to where they want to go.
I'd build on that. My first one would be to give it a go. Certainly from my experience and the speech side of things, there is some hesitancy there, but I'm really surprised and pleased that when they give it a go, they become complete converts. So I think give it a go. And if whatever technology you've found is of benefit, then shout about it. Spread the news. I think that's really important as well. And I suppose just to finish off that sort of giving something a go, rather than saying no, just say why not.
I love that. Why not? Yes, I'm going to say that more often, but why not? We've always done it this way, but why don't we do it differently? For those listening today, how can people find out more about you and your work?
The Nuance website is full of really good, useful information, or you can contact me directly at my email address, which is simon.wallace@nuance.com.
And for me, first port of call would be LinkedIn. Find me on LinkedIn. Look forward to any onward conversation.
Fantastic discussion today, gentlemen. I really enjoyed that. I've learned a lot. It's changed my perception about a number of things. And going forward, I will be singing the praises of Microsoft and Nuance. So thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the Actionable Futurist podcast. You can find all of our previous shows at actionablefuturist.com. And if you like what you've heard on the show, please consider subscribing via your favorite podcast app so you never miss an episode. You can find out more about Andrew and how he helps corporates navigate a disruptive digital world with keynote speeches and C-suite workshops delivered in person or virtually at actionablefuturist.com. Until next time, this has been the Actionable Futurist Podcast.